Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his first novel, Bombardiers, Poe Bronson profiled the cutthroat world of bond traders on Wall Street. Then he turned, famously, to Silicon Valley's wild 1990s joyride. Now, after the bust, Poe Bronson is telling stories of transformation in the lives of everyday Americans, of men and women pondering the ultimate question, what should I do with my life? Tonight on Point, finding our way and a truer place in the world with writer Poe Bronson. But first, the latest polling data from Iowa suggests Monday's key Democratic presidential caucus continues to shift from a two-man battle between Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt to a real horse race with John Kerry and John Edwards pushing forward. The most ground has been made by Kerry, who, according to today's Reuters MSNBC Zogby poll, has opened up a five-point lead over his tightly bunched rivals. John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us now from Des Moines. Good evening and welcome, John Harwood.
Great to be here.
Good to have you. John, what do you see out there? Are the polls reflected in the talk that you hear in Iowa? Is John Kerry really on some kind of a fast march here?
John Kerry's definitely on a march. Everybody, including Howard Dean's campaign, agrees on that. What you've got to be wary of, though, is how much those polls are going to predict what happens on caucus night. A couple of reasons for that. One is the caucus is a unique political exercise in which you've got to get people out on a cold night to spend a couple of hours.
Yep.
That's not so easy. So sometimes people who express a preference over the telephone may not make it out. The other is that Iowans have absolutely been bombarded with phone calls from all these candidates. And there are some people who are just not answering their phones right now.
We found that right here. Iowans just have their phones off the hook. The poll supposed to be is of 503 likely caucus goers, and it's been taken every day this week. John Zogby says any one of these four can win. We should say it looks at this point like a more or less wide open four-man race.
It is. Now, the question is, can the two hot candidates, and those are John Kerry and John Edwards, as you mentioned, do they have the on-the-ground machinery to turn out bodies on caucus night and convert that support, that momentum, into a really strong showing? Nobody disagrees that Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean have the two best organizations in the state, but they're also the two guys who are not moving up right now. Dean is shedding some voters that are going to Kerry, liberal whites, generally speaking, who the two have been trading for some months now. Kerry did well initially, then Dean took them all away. Now some of them are going back to John Kerry. But it's going to be a real battle of momentum versus organization.
John, describe to us on Monday night how those organizations may pay off. Apart from just getting voters to the poll, and that's a big piece of organization in itself, how much does it matter how finely oiled the machine is once Iowans are in their caucus settings?
Well, there's some gamesmanship that goes on because once people get inside their caucus site, they divide up into groups supporting various candidates. If your group, if you support Senator Edwards, for example, and your group is not 15% of all those in the room, then those people are dispersed. They can go to another candidate. They can go to an uncommitted group. And so people have got to pay attention to what other candidates' second choices are if they're not viable. And candidates may also try to orchestrate some gamesmanship in terms of putting non-viable voters with the candidates they don't want to do well.
There's always a debate about how important Iowa is, whether we're too much in the thrall of it. But when candidates have poured as much energy into this race as these clearly have, does that make it more important, John?
It does. And Howard Dean especially, his campaign has not been shy about saying, we are playing to win here. We're going for an early knockout. They've invested heavily. And this is where we're going to see whether, in fact, Howard Dean's campaign can turn out all the new voters that they've pledged to bring to the process and convert the energy that they showed earlier in the year into delivery on caucus night. You know, Dick Gephardt appeals to an older crowd. Elderly voters make up a large proportion of those who show up on caucus night. So that's one real question. Will these young Deaniacs turn out in the numbers that will match the support they've amassed over the months?
And finally, John, remind us of the schedule on Friday night. When will results begin to appear? Will people know if they stay up for the late news, or is it a Tuesday morning outcome?
No, I think they're going to know. I was talking the other night to the director of the Iowa Democratic Party. She thinks by 10:30, 11 o'clock Eastern time, we're going to know the results here. News organizations are taking what they call entrance polls to give themselves a sense of what's going on. But in a race this close, nobody's going to call the race until they get the results from the party. But we're not going to have to wait until the morning to get the results, I don't believe.
So right down to the wire, and we'll know a lot on Monday night. John Harwood, thank you for being with us.
You bet.
John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Des Moines, Iowa. From lawyer to cake maker, publicist to horticulturalist, Harvard Business School grad to California police officer, writer Poe Bronson interviewed nearly 1,000 Americans in the throes of life-altering change for his best-selling book, What Should I Do With My Life? They shared the most intimate insights into why they chose to embark on a lifelong dream or not, how they justified leaving fat salaries behind, how they went from Washington, D.C. to Napa Valley, how they persevered and sometimes failed. 1 year from their publication, those stories are still making waves. Tonight on Point, Rethinking Purpose, Vocation, and Life with Poe Bronson. Are you struggling with a New Year's resolution to turn over a new leaf, make a new life? What are you trying to do with your life? Do you know? Have you asked the question? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Seattle is Poe Bronson, author of the best-selling What Should I Do With My Life? The True Stories of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. It's just come out in paperback, and in our jostling time and jobless recovery, people are still asking. Poe Bronson, welcome. It's good to have you.
Hey, thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it.
It's good to have you with us. You went out and talked to so many people, and I know it's getting to be a couple of 3 years before you began this this journey into the question. But I wonder, Poe Bronson, it's such a kind of big, ungainly, juicy, sloppy question. What should I do with my life? It's the stuff of lots of daytime television talk shows. And yet you're a smart guy, and you put it to smart people. How many of them were able to sit down with you and really present an answer?
I was interested in their stories. I was interested in the social documentary of their life journey. And I was interested in stories of people, because it often makes better stories, people who'd been willing to make some sacrifice or make a significant change or resist some temptation or overcome some obstacles, because those were sort of stories worth telling. And you asked how many. I mean, it was over 900 people whose stories I took down in a premature way, and then about a 100 I took down in a very, very serious way, lots of time with the people, and about maybe 50 to 60 of their stories are in the book now.
Poe Bronson, you came to this undertaking with a story yourself. Your renown as a writer really mushroomed in the 90s as the whole 90s boom took off.
Yeah.
So that we can understand how you came to this project, where were you in your own life story, Poe?
You mentioned earlier at the top of the hour how I'd been writing about Silicon Valley, and as I started to see that world smell, I'd run from it. And I'd run from it to Hollywood. This is one of the only times you could ever say that Hollywood seemed more honest and true than somewhere else.
What year did you put on your running shoes, Poe?
August of 1999.
Okay, good timing.
I went down there and I worked on a TV pilot. I wrote a couple scripts, a feature script and a made-for-TV script, and then began work on a TV show that was set on Wall Street. It was my old material. It was a show called The Street on the Fox Network, Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock.
And Wall Street worked for you because you'd done the business school thing or the business world thing. You'd been a bond trader yourself and written about that.
Yeah, my first book, Bombardiers, had been set on Wall Street among the world of bond traders. Mm-hmm. I knew that world intimately, and the show was fun to do, but 5 million viewers a week is not enough in Hollywood, and rightly so. We were canceled to make way for Temptation Island. No small ego blow there. And I was out of work. And my book editor had left the book business to go into film. And the magazines that I wrote for had gone from 400 pages thick down to 70 pages and could no longer pay me by the word to write much at all. And I was really like, how am I going to make some money and how am I going to take care of my family? Because I had a son on the way, my first, and my wife would be on leave, and I felt a lot of pressure there. But I'd made a lot of choices as a writer that had been hard to make, and I wasn't sure I should turn my back on those. And honestly, I felt responsible in a way for having led people to uproot their lives and join the startup mania of the 90s. And I'd spent some time asking that question, what's next? But then it occurred to me, you know, rather than looking for what the next boom is, I was interested, just drawn to what's permanent, like what lasts? Like, are there any people out there who don't go searching for just the next ride, but look for something that's going to last them for a long time? And I was shifting artistically from being cynical, from being ironic, from loving people but also laughing at them a lot, to wanting to just embrace real life and real people and find some authenticism. And I just looked tonally craving that in my life. And that led me to begin this book. And when my son Luke was born, my wife, primarily at her encouragement, we began to travel and see the people all around the country that I had been talking to over the phone and writing to. And the book unfolded over the course of the next year and a half.
So what was your conclusion after talking with so many people, nearly 1,000, 900 plus, and some more in the new paperback edition that's out now? That's a big number, almost big enough to begin to be, you know, able to do a survey or a proper poll. What percentage of people that you sat down and talked to really had a bead on what they should, what they felt they should be doing with their life? How self-aware were people in general? What percentage had a grip on that?
Okay, I was looking for stories that I'd already sort of pre-screened that showed me something. So this is not representative of America at large, but of my body, there were, I would say, a third of the people really seemed to have found some place that was really working for them. They felt great about it. They felt like they'd come to some answer. They hoped it would last a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Another third had made some heroic shifts and were still in process. I was impressed by how far they had come, even as they freely admitted they had further to go.
Mm.
And then the last third were people who I thought I just found to be in a very sort of curious and interesting part of the early part of the search, and that they had a tremendous amount of anxiety. And of those three, they all told their stories differently. The people who'd found it kind of talked about it in the past tense in a way that it wasn't very raw.
I did this. I made this journey.
Yeah. And the people who are in the middle of it right now, their stories are so raw, so pregnant, that they brought a kind of urgency to the text that it needed, because I wanted to infuse these stories with emotion, with the kind of real life struggle that it is for people.
And they couldn't be honest if you didn't. It is a struggle.
Yeah, and we didn't want to make it sort of canned, like, and here's how I became successful, you know, or here's the seven steps I did.
Mm.
I was interested more in honoring it as a journey. And so some people found answers. You know, I'd say a third of the people that I interviewed had, you know, found an answer.
And the people who had found an answer, was there any consistency to how they'd done it? Had they made major mid-course corrections, or had they just had true bearings to begin with out of the gate?
Of the 900 people I interviewed, only one person always knew what he wanted to do and was doing it, and was significantly far enough into his life that it didn't look like it was going to turn his back. He was an aerospace engineer at NASA by the name of Russell Carpenter, and he'd gone to work for NASA in the summers during college, and NASA had helped pay for his way through college and graduate school and that kind of thing.
So he too had resisted
temptation. Yeah.
What kind of temptation? You mean to stray from that path?
Exactly. Temptation to get into private space exploration. Temptation to, as an engineer, to sort of leave NASA and go work in the dot-com boom. Temptation to go into politics. Temptation to stay in Houston and not go to Washington, where his to Goddard, where his instincts were telling him to go.
All the detours off that path. On the other hand, there might have been other people who were sticking to a path and maybe shouldn't have. You know, Poe, it's interesting. When you began writing this, it was people bailing out or being thrown out of the boom. Now we're in this jobless recovery, a sort of second round of contemplation going on, people wondering how long their jobs will last, if they need to be redirecting things in order to stay true, not just to themselves, but to a paycheck. It still works. I guess the question is still a big one. Poe Bronson, we've got to take a short break. Please stand by. We're talking tonight about life and what to do with it with Silicon Valley writer turned oral historian Poe Bronson. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Are you still looking for your way? Have you found it? How did you find it? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life and what to do with it with Silicon Valley writer Poe Bronson. Now he's looking right across the country. He's been talking with a lot of people about their lives and what they think they ought to be. His book, out a year ago and out now in paperback, with new stories included, What Should I Do With My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you struggling with a New Year's resolution to turn over a new leaf, a new life, to make your life matter? Are you tempted to walk away from a career that doesn't fit? Have you tried? And have you been forced to walk away from a job that disappeared? How are you recreating yourself, figuring out what you should be doing with your life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Poe Bronson, you laid out these three sort of big clusters of people that you found, those who'd really found their way, those who were struggling toward it, and those who were living in anxiety and hadn't found it. We should give us real quick some examples. You've got so many stories in here. Maybe one of each, just real quick. Paint a picture of someone you found who'd really found their way, maybe not the guy who knew all along that he should work for NASA, but had to work in midlife to figure it out. Tell us a tale.
Rick Olson was an entertainment attorney in Pittsburgh who was doing it really, really working really hard, working long hours, wasn't really great at it, wasn't ever going to make partner, did it for 13 years. The whole time he was missing his son terribly, and he longed for something else, and particularly for a better relationship with his child. And one day he got in a hockey accident, and he shot off his heel.
Ice hockey, as in playing, yeah.
Yeah, and he broke his leg in several places. And in the ambulance, he began to laugh. Like, why are you laughing? And he said he knew that the break in his leg would be his literal break from the law. And he had to take 10 months of rehabilitation. He even went bankrupt during this period of time. But he rebuilt his leg with his son by working in the yard all the time. And after so much immobility, he longed for mobility. And he wanted that kind of close relationship with his son, Patrick. One summer in college, he'd driven a truck for a living for a moving company. And he went back to that, and he now drives a truck for a living out of Pittsburgh. He feels like what's important to him is he does love trucking. But more importantly, when he takes the keys out of the ignition, he's able to be there completely for his son. And he has a radically different kind of relationship with his son now that's really rewarding to him.
Have you kept up with him? Is truck driving still working for Rick Olson, one-time
absolutely.
Attorney, now truck driver?
Ironically, he makes a little more money now as a trucker than he did as a lawyer. Not a lot, either way. When I first began working with Rick, he would drive for 7 days, 9 days in a row, and then have several days at home to be with his son. Now he is teaching other truckers, training other truckers in Pittsburgh. And so he's not spending that much time on the road. He's able to be home a lot, even more. And he loves it. He feels like he's making an impact. He's slowed his life down to a level at which he can process it and think about it.
And when he pulls the key out of the ignition, out of the job, he's home and with his family. What about this category of seekers who are still kind of mid-journey and struggling, still raw with the journey?
I tell one story that was very raw in the book, just because we're kind of on the subject of these lawyers. The one that comes to mind was a guy who from Louisville, and whose father had come from Hoodoo Holler, and who had grown up with not even wearing shoes. And so Tim Bratcher was always trying to impress everybody that even though he was a hick from Louisville, he He was had the real stuff. And every time someone rejected him, he'd spend a lot of energy trying to impress them again.
Mm-hmm.
And like other people, he was laid off in Silicon Valley.
Mm.
But he felt like it was a blow to his status, and he wanted to fight. And slowly he figured out that he needed to stop doing that and needed to move home back to the South, which he did to Atlanta, and get in an environment where he could sort of get in touch with himself again. I was in Atlanta last week, and he hasn't figured out exactly where he should be in life. He has the persona of like a really good leader or a good politician. He's a very 6'7". He has great manners. He feels like a guy who should be running an organization of some sort, but he hasn't quite figured it out. But he's made some important steps in understanding his psychological need to impress people and moving back across the country.
But still in the middle of trying to shift gears, and it doesn't sound like it's necessarily easy. Paul Bronson, a lot of people want to join our conversation. There's much more to talk about here, but let's turn and invite them in. Deborah's calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Deborah. You're on the air.
Hi. This is a really, really fantastic conversation because exactly this thing has just happened to us, our family. Six weeks ago, I was working full-time in a software company.
Mm.
My husband was at home full-time with our 4-year-old daughter, and also he used to be a carpenter and has been working on our house while he was home.
And that was the picture 6 weeks ago. What now, Deborah?
Well, I got laid off. One morning, all of a sudden, I was called into a conference room and handed an envelope.
Merry Christmas.
And Merry Christmas, exactly, 2 weeks before Christmas, very nice. And really, it was quite a terrifying experience because suddenly we had no income. And, fortunately, we had just last year kind of reorganized our finances so that we had a little bit of a cushion. And we met with our financial advisor and said, for the last few years, we've been talking about how unhappy we've been with this situation. My husband was kind of frustrated because he's a therapist. He's a psychiatric social worker and has really wanted to get his career back on track.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us make stuff. He makes all kinds of things in his wood shop. I do all kinds of fabric arts.
So has this earthquake in your career, Deborah, led you to ask, what should I do with my life? And how are you answering? Or are you still in the terror-filled moment?
No, we are fabulous now. We have decided, we met with our financial advisor, and we said, look, do I have to run right out and, put on the suit and try to find some job that I'm really going to not be all that happy at to make this number that I was making before and get that situation back? Or can we totally change this? Have it be more of a patchwork where I start my editing business that I've always wanted to do.
Mm.
Chris starts his carpentry business that he's always wanted to do. On the side, we make the things that we want to make and try to sell them.
And a new life. Deborah, hold it right there. I want to get Paul Bronson to respond to this so far. Paul, here's a story. You're hearing it. Deborah's just 6 weeks into a change that she didn't volunteer for, but maybe she's not so sorry it's come. Given all the people you've talked to, what are you hearing in this story?
Well, a great attitude first. I'd hear stories like this and I'd map them all along the timeline. How did people feel as they were just about to start making their stuff and selling it? And then 6 months later, were they managing to really sell? Were they really managing to make ends meet? And then for those that succeeded, how did it work out? And for those that failed and maybe then they went back to their job and then they were even happier after all. Why? How could that be? Like you'd failed, and then how could that be?
Mm-hmm.
And people, just like kids need to test their parents, people need to have a need to test these fears that have been trapping them.
Test life and, limits, what they're doing, and as you say, their fears. What would your advice be?
Because a lot of us might listen to Deborah and think, boy, well, what happens if you don't sell the boutiques or whatever it is?
Right.
And we all want the best for her, but what if it fails? And ironically, there's one story in the book, and I was in Portland last night. It's about a guy who gives up his life to make electric cars.
Yeah.
And he fails. And he goes back to, he's an animator by trade, and he goes back to animation. And, they uprooted their life in the Bay Area. They moved to Portland. It didn't work out. And he's like, I'm so much happier now. I feel so much more fulfilled. And I was like, yeah, but you failed. So explain that to me. And it is about that that sense of having tested it, of having known yourself.
So here's Deborah. She's smart. She's committed. As you say, she's got a good attitude right out of this trauma. And we all hope it works out for her. But what piece of advice can you slip her as she, you know, as she gears up to go for this new thing?
It's good for you whether you succeed or fail. That you can learn about yourself as a human being. You can test your limits whether you succeed or fail. And we as listeners, of course, we think, well, what if it doesn't work out? Well, my point is, good things can come of it even if it fails.
And Deborah, we hope that it works out for you, but there's a win either way, as Poe Bronson sees it. And thanks for your call. Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This show is spot on. I was forced out of the high-tech industry 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I 15 years in high-tech, traveling around the globe. I was out in Silicon Valley at a startup, and I was laid off. And I got to tell you, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life.
Did you know it at the time, Steve?
I didn't know it at the time. I did have a severance package, so it wasn't that difficult for me to move on. But I got into the nonprofit world, and I started working with youth and started an organization that recycled PCs for community technology centers in Cambridge and Somerville. And I just have my advice to everyone listening to the show is stop chasing the buck and follow your heart. And if you feel like you want to do something purposeful in your life, and you're lacking that satisfaction, then just take a break and look around you and really, really think about, what you want to do. And I think if you follow your heart and you're really true to yourself, then the money will follow.
Steve, what's it done for your wallet, and what's it done for your heart?
Well, for my wallet, it's actually killed it, to be quite honest with you. I went from making a six-figure salary to making not much at all in the last couple of years.
Is that okay? Are you dealing with that?
I am dealing with that, and actually I just started a new organization this year that's hopefully going to earn some revenue. But I've helped so many kids. I've got involved, and I sit on several nonprofit boards, and I really feel like I'm making a difference in the world, albeit small in the community. But my cholesterol dropped 50 points. I stopped all, some obsessive activities of eating so much and drinking so much because you're trying to balance a 90-hour work week and
right,
all
right,
that.
Right, right, right. Find satisfaction in a bowl of something.
Yeah. And I have to suggest to the people listening to really go out and get Poe's book and listen to this conversation because it really does make a difference in the world.
Steve, thank you very much for your call. Poe Bronson, how about it? Here's Steve who says, look, I cut my income down to a third of what it was, but I'm happier. Now, the people who haven't done that, I'm sure hear that and say, oh, my gosh, how could I possibly do that? What have you found? Is this unusual? I mean, people, can they really cut their income, by two-thirds or so and still be smiling, find that big satisfaction on the other side?
Tom, I think that people were chasing money because they thought it would lead to some sort of sense of freedom, financial freedom, mm-hmm. freedom from worries. I found that that was usually naive, that people just ended up on a roller coaster chasing more money. That true financial freedom is having the confidence you can live within the means afforded by something you feel good about. Now, to your direct question, can everybody live on a third? No, you can't. Not everybody can. Between Deborah's story and Steve's story, I've heard of two people who are sort of theoretically sort of going without a lot less money.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a trade-off between income and psychic income. But there's people in my book, certainly, and many of the people that I interviewed, they were being a poor teacher and they dreamed of being an engineer and they found a way to do that. They were a homeless guy who dreamed of being a marine construction diver, which is very lucrative, and he's doing that. There are people who are businessmen, people who are salesmen, people who are dentists, people who are doctors. One of the things it's easy to imagine, we can't all go off and run bed and breakfasts mm-hmm. on the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody actually wants to do that. Some people actually want to make a contribution to the world, and they'll get paid very well for doing it.
And have more satisfaction if it's closer to what they really want to be doing or really ought to be doing. But what did you find the biggest fears that kept people – Deborah got kicked right out of the nest and maybe is glad that she did, but people who have the – for whom it's at their own option. What are the biggest fears that kept them from making a move towards something that they might rather be doing, even when they wanted to, even when they thought they should? What held people back?
Kind of like text and subtext, Tom. The text, it's out there. We all know the answer. Never enough money, never enough time. but there were psychological fears that were the subtext that were often really ruling people's decisions. Simply, you know, the embarrassment of failure, the fear of being unique and standing out from the crowd, the fear of one-wayness, that if you make this choice, you can't go back.
The door will slam behind you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fear of what your parents will think or what your spouse will think or your partner will think. Notions of class and how we assume we won't get along with people. Well, we need to hang around with people like us.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, hanging out with people who aren't like you and learning to love them is in fact one of the greatest experiences of our life that we can have. And so the long list of sort of psychological issues that seem to be at work that trapped people, and to overcome them or at least attack them and challenge them was itself felt really good. It sort of broadened people's horizons.
I hear that. Dennis is on the line. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
I am the other side of the coin of your previous two callers.
Okay.
I'm 44 years old. I've had 10 jobs since I graduated college in 81.
All right.
And I still have no idea what I want to be when I grow up.
None of them feel right, Dennis? Or why do you keep changing?
I've kind of let my career take me where it will. I mean, I say 10 different companies, but a lot of that's been in consulting and training and project management.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I fall into the category. Maybe this isn't in Poe's book, but I think I'm a shoulda. I'm one of these people who's always done what I think I should.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the last few comments that your guest has said have really resonated. On the surface, I say I'm too scared to do this because I have a partner and I have a son and I can't survive
mm-hmm.
on half my salary.
Mm-hmm.
But below that is the fundamental question of, well, if money weren't an issue, what would I do?
Well, Dennis, let me ask you, do you have an inkling of what it is that you're afraid to face, afraid to articulate, or you honestly all the way down have no idea where your puzzle piece fits in?
I think I'm all over the map. I think at one point I'd like to go into acting, and another point I'd like to write comic books, and another point I think I'd love to be a teacher and help kids. And how do you draw a pattern from any of that? Maybe I should be talking to a psychiatrist.
I don't think so. I think it's pretty natural, but a lot of longing there, not so much certainty about where to go. Poe Bronson, what do you hear in Dennis's story?
Passion and curiosity. It's not like you stumble upon one calling and that's going to light you up. Passion and curiosity are like a muscle. You nurture it. You make it strong. It helps you make decisions over the course of your life. We don't necessarily want to try to find our calling. We just want to be people, kind of person who doesn't ignore your calls.
But Dennis has had 10 stabs at it, and he still feels like he's not on the rails, not on the beam.
He didn't take 10 stabs. That's not what he said. What he said is he followed the opportunities that came his way.
True, okay.
And it led him to 10 different companies mm-hmm. in pretty much the same area, and that he never really took his own control of what his life. He was sort of using what came his way. But even then, we're talking about trade-offs here between sort of being a consultant and, as he said, you know, being an actor. I'll just give you a discernment story of another type. My father sold insurance for years, and he got very successful, and they all wanted to make him a manager, and he tried it. And he's like, I'm not a manager. I'm a salesman. He's still in the insurance business, but just knowing where you belong, it's not like you have to use your hobbies. It's about discernment. It's about figuring out where you fit.
Dennis, keep that flashlight on. We hope you find the thing that's right for you. We're talking tonight about life and what to do with it with Silicon Valley writer Poe Bronson. You can join the conversation. What are you trying to do with your life? Do you know? Do you? Ask yourself. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life and what to do with it with Silicon Valley writer turned career-watching life counselor Poe Bronson. His book is What Should I Do With My Life? The True Story of People Who Answered the Ultimate Question. Poe Bronson came to it out of Silicon Valley. As the bubble blew up, you may be in the middle of it yourself right now. What do you think? Are Americans more focused today on what they should be doing with their lives or not? And are you contemplating a big change? Why? What are you looking for? Have you answered that ultimate question? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Poe, you, at the end of the book, you lay out some of the things that you say you learned from this 900 inquiries and several dozen deep inquiries. I wonder if we can just go through those and get you to speak to them a bit, maybe give us some anecdotes that may illustrate. First one, you say, a calling is not something you know, it's something you grow into through trials and mistakes.
One out of 900 knew what he wanted to do and did it. The rest of us have to figure it out. And it's up for us to learn to negotiate between those voices that call to do something that has no money and those opportunities that do have money, and slowly figure out a place where we can make ends meet and feel fulfilled. And then and only then will we find that sort of, not radical permanence, but sense of fit that can last for some time. You know, when Studs Terkel wrote his incredible book, Working, he unearthed these people, these incredible people who were content to stay put. And I found so many people dizzy from change and upheaval, and was looking for people who had, the few people who had found that sense that, you know, in a sense almost recession-proof because they loved it and they were so good at it that they weren't going to get laid off.
That speaks to something else you say here. Freedom is the confidence that you can live within the means of something you're passionate about. You know, whether it's big bucks or not, your wealth is really in your connection to what you're doing.
And you need to work, kind of attack it from both sides, which means look at how you spend money and why you spend money, and learn to live within the means afforded by something that works, if you can. And if you can't live within the means by that thing, then that's not a solution. You know, ruining your life chasing a dream is not a solution any more than going to a job every day that you hate. I make that very clear. And it's about finding that in-between and working for it and finding a solution that does work and then looking to the next thing, looking to the next thing.
On that
and
line,
if you don't, you'll be thrown out on the street unless you figure that out.
Well, on that line, you say, failure is hard, but success at the wrong time can lock you in forever.
Yeah, success at the wrong thing can lock you in forever. We're always afraid of what's going to fail, but meanwhile, we get habituated to the level of spending that we have, and the nice thank yous and the relatively minor promotions for doing something that we in our heart know we don't really care about and don't love. I had a meeting with the business council, this Fortune 100 CEOs, and they told me, you know, we build our companies on people, and in order to improve our companies and rescue this listing ship, we need new ideas. And those new ideas tend to come from people who are motivated and care. And please spread the word that we don't want people just to punch the clock and who are willing to endure. We want people who want to be there.
You say, don't be seduced by artificial love. What do you mean by that?
It came out of a story about a guy who had long promised that he was going to leave Hollywood, but Hollywood was always telling him, oh, we love you, we love you, we love you. And it's sort of like the previous statement of success at the wrong thing, that many of us, for very psychological reasons in our family and our upbringing, we need a lot of strokes. Mm-hmm. And we can, you know, just we can get them from some people who won't give it to us right, but they'll give us a little bit of strokes, and so we hang around. And we really need to find love that find ourselves, not find this sort of artificial love from others.
Julie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Poe. I just turned on the radio a few minutes ago, and I thought it was absolutely apropos. I've been spending the last 11 hours with one of my best friends. Took her away for the day so she could get away from it all, to figure out what she wants to do with her life. She's in her late 40s, and
she may be listening. Be careful there. It sounds like she's at some kind of crunch time, Julie. What's she wrestling with?
She's been looking for a job for 3.5 years.
Ooh, that's a long time.
Yeah, and she kind of knows what she wants to do, but she doesn't know what she wants to do, and she's been trying to shoehorn herself into things and say, well, I could do that, but she knows deep down inside that just shoehorning herself in wouldn't make her happy.
And do you think she's not finding a job, Julie, because the jobs aren't there or because she doesn't really know what she wants to do?
A little of both.
So she's going out for interviews, perhaps, but without any lack sense of direction, she's not coming across as a very talented candidate or a very motivated candidate.
Well, she's got the talent. She's got the experience. She often is up against someone who has a higher degree than she does, or they decide to hire internally.
So what was your advice to her, Julie, today?
Figure out more specifically what she wants to do. Really pinpoint it and literally send that energy out to the universe to say, hey, this is what I want to do with my life. This is what makes me tick. This is what makes me happy. This is what makes me shine. And don't worry about trying to just make the paycheck, do what you love. Literally, the money will follow. And
Julie, let us pick that up, because you've put a lot on the table right there. Poe Bronson, what about this? Here's a person, 3.5 years, hasn't found the job. You know, from your conversations, you do find people can sit down, and if they meditate hard enough, it will come to them out of the clouds, you know, like a beam of sunlight. Here's what I should do. How do people actually find that answer?
Tom, that bearing down with meditation doesn't seem to work. You know, seeing career counselors is very helpful. Seeing your minister or your rabbi can be helpful. The support of friends can be very helpful. So looking within for some period of time can be very helpful. But looking in more and more and more and more and more, just looking harder and harder, doesn't seem to do it. We can become disengaged from the world, and we need to both look for things that we have good hunches about and also expose ourselves to things that we wouldn't think we'd like at all and learn from them. You know, you have to do both. And so she's gone out in interviews, which is good. And maybe she's realized, you know, this isn't for me halfway through the interview. And as a result, she hasn't been hired, rightly so. Julie's experiencing a lot of what I experienced in this book, as I was going out looking to learn. And a lot of people turned it on me and said, what do you think? What should I do? And I'm like, I'm kind of a journalist recording your story here.
Right.
We don't usually give advice to people.
And you can't get in those conversations without that question coming up. I want to get one more call. Leo's on the line. Hi, Leo. You're on the air.
Good evening, and thank you so much for taking the call.
Good to have you.
I just want to say, aren't we lucky and privileged to even be asking this question?
That is for sure.
I am personally a very lucky person. However, strapped to the nines, I am worried about finding enough money to go buy coal for the stove. However, I had a shop that was very successful in Gloucester, and I've gone on and done lots of other things. And recently I was working as a art director and then as a teacher, and now I've gone back out on my own again. And the whole thing is actuating it, having the temerity to get out there and using it like a fly when you're fly fishing. You know, you make your presentation and you get them in, and then you got to – but getting a gaff into another human and getting them to buy into what you're doing.
But, Leo, in your first comment, I wondered if you were saying that there's something even narcissistic about the whole question, that we should just, I don't know, get out there and do whatever the road brings us. Do you think people spend too much time looking for that perfect path?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I haven't found any other choice but to do that. But it is nonetheless very, in my opinion, very narcissistic to even consider that. I mean, most of the world does not have this problem to consider, you know, how am I going to reach my reality? It gets even more complicated if you have children and whatnot. How am I going to help them reach their reality and provide an income?
But when you do have the option, you kind of have to go in and think about which one you should pick up. Well, Bronson, we've just got a minute left here. Leo raises a great point. You know, we're lucky to have these options, and yet it doesn't diminish the sense of urgency or even responsibility to figure out the best way when there are options.
No, I've got letters, and I include in the paperback letters from readers all around the world who felt like this question was really important to them. And they may not have the ability to answer it the way we do in all cases, but it still matters to them. Their lives still count. And I think we often think this is a narcissistic notion, a very consumerist, career-oriented society. I think that it's actually the opposite. I think this is part of a labor movement in which, in a sense, we are tired of being laid off all the time and being thrown around and being not making an impact. So we're looking for a place, and it's sort of a labor move, looking for a place to resist that type of an economy and find some place where things work out. And I think it's actually a long tradition of sort of the evolution of labor. Well, rather than an indulgence, it's a solution.
That sounds like an observation truly appropriate to the time. Poe Bronson, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, really appreciate it, Tom. Thank you. Really, very mean it.
Poe Bronson joined us from Seattle, Washington. His book, What Should I Do With My Life, is out in paperback. You can pick it up. A lot of stories there. Many stories. You can also continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, lamenting the brutal winter weather that has gripped much of the country, this is On Point. An Arctic blast of frigid air is shattering low temperature records across the Northeast and upper Midwest this week. It was 1 degree in New York's Central Park this morning, matching a record set in 1893. Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, saw temperatures plummet to 20 below zero, and the wind chill on the top of Mount Washington in New Hampshire hit 97 degrees below zero. Winter can be a brutal season. Oregon resident Susan Nielsen wishes that she could just hibernate for the next 2 months. Last week, a major snowstorm paralyzed much of her part of the country. In this radio diary, Susan Nielsen shares her dread as she looks forward to 9 more weeks of winter.
Now begins the part of winter that people from the Northwest don't talk about with outsiders. It is dark here. It's grayer than 50s television. Everything slows down, from the final stowing of holiday decorations to the hazy contemplation of what exactly to do with the evenings. This is called hibernation, folks. And yes, from January to early March, people in the Northwest and other dark parts of the country really do it. Ideally, we'd be in sync with the bears. Bears start to hibernate early because they don't have to celebrate Christmas. They crawl into bed after the first deep frost, and they stay there until spring. Humans aren't allowed to hibernate until January. They have holiday gifts to buy and parties to attend and decorations to set out. They have to go, go, go until suddenly, one day in January, they realize how dark and cold it got and how tired they are, and they desperately want to go to bed until spring. Not for recreational purposes, mind you. People craving hibernation fantasize about flannel sheets and heaps of blankets. They look with longing at empty beds and darkened rooms with thick curtains. To a Northwesterner in winter, burrowing in bed until spring is the most tantalizing idea possible. Wake us when the daffodils come, we say to no one in particular. One more tap on the snooze button and I'm up, really. This is hard to explain to outsiders who ask us how we make it through the long, dark, rainy winters. It's not so bad, we say. The beautiful summers and falls make up for it, we say. But in truth, we're not sure how we make it because we don't remember. It passes in a mist of darkened commutes and slow-burning fires and soup. All of us have coping techniques. We drink more. We escape to the mountains driving above the clouds for a day of skiing or a quick blast of the sun. We try to entertain ourselves with television and books and games, or we organize the house by moving piles of paper around. Every now and then something happens. The recent snowstorm, referred to as the worst storm in the history of the spinning planet briefly, was a huge event. The snow and ice were a terrible inconvenience for many and life-threatening or costly for others. But for many of us, it was just a diversion, a flash of white in the months of gray. All last week, I wondered why the Northwest couldn't just shut down for the winter, why we wouldn't stop the presses and turn off the hospitals and all agree to hibernate, like the bears, until spring. But as it turns out, even bears don't hibernate like the bears. They're too big to freeze themselves like the Arctic ground squirrels or other small critters. The energy required for large mammals to cool their body temperatures that much would be, quote, metabolically extravagant, in the delicious words of the science writers at the Encyclopedia Britannica. So bears simply fall into a deep winter lethargy. They can move if they must, but they try not to. It is winter, after all, a time to avoid metabolic extravagance. Nature says so, and people from the Northwest know so.
Susan Nielsen is a columnist with the Oregonian newspaper. She lives in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.